You are listening to the Already Gone podcast, sharing stories of the missing, the lost, the mysterious, and the murdered.
Benton County, Arkansas is on the western edge of Arkansas, right on the Oklahoma border. It's on the northern edge of the state as well, snuggled up against Missouri. In 1989, in the little town of Hiawassee, Dana Stidham, a petite brunette, was on the edge of adulthood. 18-year-old Dana had just graduated high school, Gravette High, class of 89. She had moved into an apartment with her brother, 21-year-old Larry. Over the summer, she was enjoying her freedom, enjoying that wide-open space between high school and growing up. She had a job and a car and a group of friends. She loved attending the weekend dances in Gravette as well. From all accounts, Dana was well-liked, a typical teenager, and a good kid. July 25th, 1989. Dana stopped by her parents' home to do some laundry. During the visit, she talked with her dad, Lawrence, about moving back home. She wanted to enroll at the University of Arkansas, and living at home would help her save a bit of money. Her dad thought that sounded like a fine idea. On that hot, humid summer day, Lawrence wasn't feeling his best. He asked Dana to run to the store for him, pick up something from the pharmacy for his stomach. He handed her a few dollars. She bid her father farewell and headed out on her errand. It was the last time Lawrence Stidham would see his daughter. It was after 2 p.m. when Dana headed out towards the Phillips food store in nearby Bella Vista. On the way to the store, she stopped to put gas in her car, a 1984 Dodge Omni. Dana used to work at Phillips and chatted with former co-workers while shopping. They recall her wearing a white top with red trim, white shorts, red socks, and white sneakers. Dana seemed happy and untroubled. Dana didn't shop the Phillips store solely to visit with her friends. She was intentionally avoiding the convenience store near her parents' house in Hiawassee. To her, it was better to make the longer drive, about 8 miles, to Bella Vista than shop at the local business. While in Bella Vista, she purchased Alka-Seltzer, sugar, and dishwashing liquid. The receipt was time-stamped 3:17 p.m. When Dana didn't return to her parents' house in time for dinner, they became concerned. In the 1980s, the dark days before cell phones, parents had to call landlines at other houses and ask after their missing child. Dana's father and Georgia, her mother, made a few calls, and as dusk approached, they got in their cars and drove around looking for her, thinking perhaps she'd run out of gas or had car trouble. There was no sign of their daughter or her car. They drove up and down U.S. Highway 71, searched along Hiawassee Road, as well as checking the lots at both stores for signs of Dana or her car. They returned home empty-handed. Danny Varner, a family friend and sheriff with the Bella Vista Division of the Benton County Sheriff's Department, got a call that evening from a concerned Lawrence Stidham. Dana was missing. Could Danny please help them? By 9 p.m. that night, a bolo was issued for Dana Stidham and her car, the Dodge Omni. For those of you not familiar with the term, a bolo is a be-on-the-lookout, advising law enforcement that someone is missing or needs to be located. Another similar term is ATL, or attempt to locate. Call it what you'd like. The sheriff's department was actively searching for the 100-pound, 5'2" brunette. July 26th, 6:30 a.m. Sheriff Karen Myers was driving into work at the Buena Vista substation and made a mental note of a disabled car on U.S. Highway 71 near Wellington Road. Behind the car was a pickup with a camper. There was a man kneeling beside the Dodge like he was changing a flat tire. When she sat in on the morning briefing and learned of the bolo, she was eager to return to the car she'd seen that morning. Sure enough, it was Dana's vehicle. The pickup, an older model Ford, green with wood-paneled sides, was gone. You can see a picture of a similar vehicle on our website. A description of this man was not made public, but police did trace the car, the Ford, back to Florida. In the first of what would be a series of strange occurrences, Dana's parents had driven up and down Highway 71 the previous evening. They would have seen the vehicle during their search. When investigators accessed Dana's car, they noted the driver's window was halfway down. The items she'd picked up at the store, including the stomach remedy for her father, were still in a bag in the back seat. The keys were in the ignition, and the driver's seat was adjusted for someone close to 6 feet tall. Not where the petite teenager would have positioned the seat if she were driving. Dana's purse was missing. Also, one of the rear tires was low, but the car was very much drivable. The tire that needed air was the same one Sheriff Myers had seen a man working on early that morning. Investigators searched the area, including looking up and down Wellington Road for clues to where Dana could be, about half a mile up Wellington Road. They discovered Dana's laundry, items she'd washed at her parents' house the day before, scattered along the edge of the road. In many of the missing persons cases I've covered or read about, when a teenager disappears, police don't take parents' concerns seriously. Law enforcement was taking this case very seriously. Not only did they deploy officers to search, because this is a hilly area with rough terrain, they brought in tracking dogs to find the missing girl. Unfortunately, this didn't lead them any closer to finding Dana. August 5th, in Bella Vista, not far from where Dana's car was found, a family got a surprise when their dog returned home carrying a small denim handbag. Inside the purse were items identifying it as belonging to Dana. They called the sheriff to report the strange treasure their pup had procured. Investigators responded and began searching the area. They found Dana's checkbook, driver's license, and photos that she'd kept in her wallet. All of these were discovered along the edge of the road, meaning they'd most likely been thrown from a moving vehicle. The location of these items was about a mile northeast of where her car had been found, just yards from the Missouri-Arkansas state line. Energized by the find, police posted a $5,000 reward for information leading to the missing girl. New searches were organized, on foot and on horseback, going into the thick woods. No new clues were uncovered. Tips continued to come in, but nothing led them any closer to Dana. Her parents remained optimistic that their daughter would return home. September 1989. Her friends and family were hopeful that Dana would appear. She wanted to attend the University of Arkansas, and classes would start soon. The first day at university came and went with no sign of her. September 17th. A man hunting in a wooded area of Benton County made a grisly discovery. The remains of a woman in a shallow grave on the edge of a creek bed. Her body was found about 5 miles from her car along winding back roads. Dana was discovered literally a few hundred feet from the Missouri state line. Law enforcement responded. Their worst fears had materialized. Dana Linnell Stidham was dead. Someone had murdered her and concealed her body in the remote woods. Animals found her remains and pulled pieces away. Dana's sternum was never located. After nearly 2 months in the humid late summer of northern Arkansas, her remains were badly decomposed. While there was clearly a wound to her neck and a knife mark in the bone of her shoulder, a cause of death couldn't be determined. Homicidal violence was listed in place of something more specific. In this, the era before DNA testing, dental records were used to confirm that the remains belonged to Dana Stidham. Her clothing was found near her body. It had been buried with her jewelry a few feet from her remains. The white t-shirt with red trim, white shorts, red socks. Just what her friends described her as wearing on July 25th when she was last seen. When investigators examined her clothes, it was determined that her bra strap was sliced through, roughly, perhaps with a knife. There was also a t-shirt with duct tape stuck to it near the scene. Evidence collection was a challenge, the weather and the wildlife that caused a great deal of damage. October 29th, 1989. The Stidhams, now a family of three, laid their daughter and sister to rest. While Bella Vista, Gravette, and Hiawassee were three separate towns, it was one close-knit community. People were grieving and people were frightened. Violent crime happened in the big city, not in their rural and peaceful community. Local businesses, law enforcement, and members of the community all chipped in to create a $20,000 reward for information leading to her killer. When Dana's funeral was planned by her parents, they took money they'd set aside from her college fund to purchase a large custom headstone. It was pink and heart-shaped and a fitting memorial for their lovely daughter. This one-of-a-kind item would take several weeks to arrive. The cemetery placed a small plastic temporary marker on her grave to identify her resting place until the permanent marker was in place. I mentioned earlier there were strange occurrences tied to this case. Imagine the horror her parents felt when they visited the cemetery one day, only to discover that someone had stolen the temporary marker from Dana's plot. Who would do something like that? Desecrate the burial place of a deceased child? Outraged at another violation of Dana and her family, it didn't take the sheriff's department long to find out. The culprit was a former classmate of Dana's, a man named Michael Earl McMillan. McMillan had attended Gravette High School with Dana. He'd been sweet on her, but Dana wasn't interested. Let's go back for a moment to the day Dana went missing. She was headed to the store to get something for her father, who wasn't feeling well. Remember how she'd made the drive to Bella Vista to shop at Phillips store? Dana bypassed the much closer store in Hiawassee, nicknamed the Hiawassee Hilton, because it was owned by McMillan's family. It's quite likely she'd avoided the store because McMillan was always there, either working or hanging around. Dana didn't care for McMillan and avoided him when possible. There's a lot of speculation that McMillan may have been stalking or harassing Dana. This came up time and again in my research. But again, it's speculation. Friends told investigators that he'd asked her out a few times and she'd declined, repeatedly. She wasn't interested and he wasn't giving up. Investigators from the sheriff's department interviewed McMillan, asking him for an alibi. Where was he the night of July 25th? He told them he was with his girlfriend, but she did not corroborate his story. He gave the name of a different girlfriend, but she too could not provide the alibi he needed. People in town reported seeing McMillan out driving his father's Ford F-150 pickup truck in the early morning hours of July 26th, just hours after Dana vanished. McMillan's girlfriends couldn't give him an alibi for the night Dana was murdered, but they did tell investigators that after she was buried, McMillan would go to the cemetery late at night to mourn Dana. Back to Dana's grave marker, McMillan was charged with the theft, given a $100 fine, and placed on 90 days probation. 1989 became 1990, and without new information, without leads, without the forensic evidence we rely on in the 21st century, her case went cold. Investigators kept looking and interviewing and digging, but there wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest. McMillan enlisted in the Navy and left Arkansas behind. Dana's heartbroken family, her parents, Lawrence and Georgia, and her brother Larry, remained in the area. By the mid-1990s, the sheriff's department realized that without a Hail Mary play, this case wouldn't be solved. They wanted another shot at McMillan. He was known to Dana, she was rumored to be afraid of him, or at least avoiding him, and he'd stolen her grave marker. Any one of those could be explained away, but the three together was a red flag for investigators. In 1996, they tracked down the Ford F-150 pickup that McMillan's father owned, the truck he was seen driving the night that Dana vanished. It was sent to the lab to be searched for any evidence connecting the vehicle with Dana Stidham. There were hairs retrieved from the truck that were similar in structure to Dana's hair. Unfortunately, they were unable to make a solid connection between McMillan's truck and the murdered girl. I want to point out that McMillan's truck was not a match to the truck seen the morning of July 26th behind Dana's car. Different vehicles. September 1996, 7 years after Dana's body was discovered buried near a creek, Benton County Judge Terry Crabtree authorized a subpoena for a sample of McMillan's hair. McMillan's attorney, Brad Caron, protested, but the samples were taken and examined. Nothing conclusive came from their efforts in 1996. Investigators did release an interesting tidbit at that time. In one of his interviews with the sheriff's department, McMillan told detectives Mike Zadorak and Danny Varner, "Sometimes I think I did kill Dana, but I know I didn't." March 24th, 1998. Benton County Sheriff Danny Varner, who took a call from his friend in 1989, asking for help to find his missing daughter, received a call about his own child. There had been a shooting at her school, Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas. On that Tuesday afternoon, just after lunch ended, Andrew Golden pulled a fire alarm, luring his classmates and teachers outside, and then he and Mitchell Johnson opened fire on them. The ambush killed 5 people, including the daughter of Danny Varner, 11-year-old Brittany Varner. An additional 9 students and 1 teacher were injured. Both shooters were sentenced to prison until they turned 21, and both were released around 2005. February 1999. Dana's father dies at the age of 50. June 2015. Dana's brother, Larry, dies at age 47. This leaves only Georgia Stidham to wait for justice in the death of her daughter. In May of 2013, Bella Vista was rocked by another attack, one eerily similar to the death of Dana Stidham. A man riding his horse spotted a body near a creek bed in northern Benton County. This time, the woman was still alive. She'd been shot in the face and dumped out of a vehicle, left for dead in a remote area, very close to where a hunter discovered Dana 20 years before. Annette Rapoli was transported to the hospital and survived the attack. Investigators were hopeful that the man who had assaulted her, 61-year-old Orville Goodwin, could be the man who murdered Dana. Goodwin had been interviewed as a person of interest back in 1989, and this attack was similar to Dana's death.
New information tonight in a 24-year-old cold case. The Benton County Sheriff's Office has reopened the investigation into Dana Stidham's murder. Stidham's body was found in the woods around Bella Vista 2 months after she disappeared back in 1989. No one was ever charged with her death. The sheriff says they're now using new technology and taking a second look at some people who may be involved in the case. In an exclusive interview, the sheriff said one of those people is this man, Orville Goodwin. He's accused of shooting a woman in the face back in May and leaving her to die in a Bella Vista creek bed.
As far as his involvement in with the Dana Stidham case, again, there is information that we believe is valuable to the case, and it may or may not include him, but it is some information that we need to corroborate.
The sheriff says investigators also plan to talk to a man named Michael McMillan, who went to high school with Stidham.
Let's talk about some theories related to Dana's murder. I would like to know more about the man seen near the ranchero-style truck with the camper. Sheriff Myers spotted him the morning of July 26th. There's very little information on this person. Was he cleared? Who was he? What was he doing to Dana's car, and why isn't he mentioned in more recent stories about the murder? A ranchero or El Camino-style vehicle with a camper. That's pretty distinctive. The small-town rumor mill worked overtime when Dana disappeared, and it's still churning out stories 25 years later. One story, perhaps tied to the vehicle with the camper, involves a former boyfriend of Dana's, one whose brother works in law enforcement. Could this former boyfriend somehow be tied to her death? With Dana's body being left in such a remote place, it would have to be someone familiar with the area, which makes Dana's high school acquaintance, Mark Earl McMillan, an interesting possibility. He was rumored to be carrying a torch for Dana. His girlfriends reported that he went to the cemetery at night to mourn her privately, and he stole her temporary grave marker. Aside from the subpoenas related to this case in 1996, I'm not aware of any further legal troubles for McMillan in the years since he stole Dana's grave marker. Finally, Orville Goodwin sounds like a viable suspect, especially since his attack in 2013 had many parallels to Dana's murder, and he was questioned when Dana's remains were discovered in 89. I believe law enforcement ruled him out as a suspect in Dana's case after he shot Annette Rapoli in 2013. Orville Goodwin would be sentenced to 12 years in prison for the shooting. Do you have a theory? Share it on Twitter at AlreadyGonePod or leave a comment on our website or on Facebook. If you have any information about the murder of Dana Stidham, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-877-842-8200. Dana's case remains open, active, and unsolved. Thank you for listening to the Already Gone podcast, and please, be safe.